for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A major offensive by U.S., NATO, and Afghan troops in southern Afghanistan entered its seventh day today. Militant sniper fire and the use of civilians as human shields have slowed progress in the U.S.-led campaign against Taliban fighters. President Obama met in Washington with the Dalai Lama despite Chinese objections. And a Haitian court freed 8 of 10 American missionaries arrested on child abduction charges. Joining me to talk about the top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, Moises Naim of Foreign Policy Magazine, Karen DeYoung at The Washington Post, and James Kitfield of The National Journal. As always, you are a very important part of the program. Call us with your questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org and join us on Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning. Good morning.
Happy Friday to you. Moises, the U.S., NATO, and Afghan forces have launched this major offensive in Marja. To what extent is it working?
This is the largest offensive in the last 8 years. It's 15,000 troops and more. The British Major General Nick Carter, who is the commander there, said that this is we are at the stage in which is the beginning of the end. The end of the beginning, which means that they have successfully staged the first phases of the attack, and now the big challenge is to hold it and then try to work with the civilian population and try to deal with the non-military aspects of this offensive.
Karen.
I think that there's been a lot of reporting that the offensive has been going up and down. One day we hear that they've cleared major portions of the city of Marja, which is in the middle of a larger district that they're trying to hold. This is all in Helmand province in the far southwest of Afghanistan. The next day, we're told that there are large pockets of resistance, a lot of sniper fire, that there have been engagements of various units. Clearly, the Taliban have wired the place with a lot of roadside bombs.
And using women and children.
These are not new tactics for the Taliban, but yes, they're making it difficult for the coalition troops, who are also stymied a little bit because of the new rules that have been put in place by General McChrystal, the commander there, about civilians. They're very worried about having civilian casualties. They want to use air power in a very limited way. They're not allowed to go into places where they think civilians might be. The Afghans have to go first. But I think that what appears to be happening is that the Taliban are engaging them again in small pockets. Many of them have left the area or are leaving the area. Yeah. And I think for the coalition, that's okay, because what they want to do is to be able to control this particular area, which has been a Taliban stronghold, and establish some kind of governance, some kind of development assistance, to have it be a model for other areas to get them not to accept the Taliban in their regions.
And then James says, I understand the tactic. It's to establish concentric circles becoming wider and wider from Marja.
Right. They call it the ink blot strategy, where you have the first ink blot and you try to expand it. But this, what to me is really interesting about this offensive is, you know, we have the Afghan surge, much like we had the Iraq surge in the winter and spring of 2007. He has the troops now to launch a major offensive like this. And he really is the template for the counterinsurgency strategy that he's going to use, or we're going to either succeed or fail on this strategy. So Marja is very important for what it represents in this, how this strategy works. They've got what they call a government in the box, ready to roll in day one. They had a lawyer, Yerga, and a sub-governor who's ready to take control immediately. They've got millions of dollars of reconstruction funds ready to be spent. So as soon as they, you know, they understand now that the second, third, and fourth phase of these operations are often the most critical. What you do when the last shot is fired, the Taliban goes away, how you win the people to the government that you place in there, that's the critical thing. And we'll be able to see it over the next months whether that really works. If it does, I think it bodes well that we might be able to repeat the success of the Iraqi surge in Afghanistan.
And at the same time, you've got several top Afghan Taliban leaders captured in Pakistan. What's the significance there, James?
It's very significant, and Karen should talk to this because she wrote a very good piece in today's Washington Post. But we've been trying for months, high-level discussions and pressure, to finally get the Pakistan government to say not just the Pakistan Taliban is a threat to you, but the Afghan Taliban, which is a threat to us in Afghanistan, is also a threat to you. It seems like they're starting to make a lot of progress on that. For the first time, they went after Fethullah Massoud, the head of the Pakistan Taliban, killed him with a drone strike some months ago. Now we are seeing them with the CIA go after Afghan Taliban people, and that's a very important move on the part of the Pakistanis. It seems like there's a level of cooperation we haven't seen yet.
Karen.
I don't think that there's I don't think that there's any new great love between the Americans and the Pakistanis. There's still an enormous level of suspicion. There are many years of mistrust there. But what I do think has happened is that the administration, by lowering the temperature of its criticism, its public criticism of the Pakistanis, and by trying to prove to them that it is in their interest to do this, that, you know, they've been supporting the Afghan Taliban because they're not sure what the Americans are going to do in Afghanistan, and they want to have a say. That's a very important part of their regional strategy. They want to be with the winning side there. But I think that over the past several months, the administration has done a very systematic wooing of the Pakistanis and a very calculating effort to convince them that the Americans are going to stay. They're going to stay in Afghanistan. They're going, in some role or other, they're going to stay in Pakistan, continue with money, continue with assistance, and that it is in the Pakistanis' best interest to help this.
How much do the Pakistanis themselves fear the influx, the takeover by the Taliban, Moises?
Well, for a while, they didn't. And for a while, there was a strong support and general collaboration even between the Inter-Services Intelligence Services of Pakistan,
ISI,
which is the spy agency in Pakistan with the Taliban. To illustrate the complexity of the situation, we now have conflicting reports about the capture of Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, which is this number two operational leader of the Taliban. There is a report in the New York Times today that says that he was captured. It was an accident that they were going after a group of leaders, thanks to the new collaboration that they have, in which, as Karen reported in today's Washington Post, one of the advances in recent days is that the U.S. Intelligence services are able to operate in Karachi. But so when they went to this place and they found him as a big prize. Now, they're not allowing the Americans to interrogate him. They are being very careful because the problem is that he may know too much about the way in which the Pakistani government cooperated with the Taliban. It can be an embarrassment for the Pakistan government. And also some argue that he may be Mullah Baradar may be a leader in the future with whom you would want to have negotiations.
Karen.
I think that it's in some senses it's immaterial if he was the exact person they were going after. I think what happened is the Pakistanis agreed to allow the U.S. intelligence to do real-time intercepts on the ground of communications on the ground in Pakistan.
And that was among the first times.
Yes, this has always been a disagreement. The Americans have said to the Pakistanis, you know where these people are. Mm-hmm. Here's the intelligence. Go pick them up. The Pakistanis have said, your intelligence is bad. You don't know what you're talking about. And so the Americans said, look, okay, we'll let us in. We'll sit there, we'll do the intercepts, we'll hand them to you in real time, and go get these people. And so they went to get people, and this is one of the people that they got.
You know, I think we should put this in some context. You know, I think it was on this show last year when the Taliban took over the SWAT and came within 60 miles of, not Karachi, but of Islamabad, where we said, look, this is either a tipping point or a turning point. And since then, we've seen the Pakistani security forces retake SWAT. They launched an offensive in South Waziristan. They allowed for a huge increase in the drone strikes that's been very under the radar, but we've really increased the number of drone strikes. We killed Fethullah Masood, who's the top Pakistan-Afghan-Taliban leader, and now we're going after Afghan-Taliban leaders that we've said forever have been in Quetta. So, you know, you see a progression here that it was a turning point, I think, with the Pakistanis, that they are finally starting to see that we share a common enemy here, and that's probably a bit of good news.
But, you know, I think this is, too, the Obama administration would say that this is evidence of the success of their strategy in a larger sense to show some respect for other countries that disagree with us. You know, the Pakistani case throughout has been, we don't get no respect. You have dissed us for years. And, again, we want to hedge our bets. Don't think that we see everything the way you do. And so they have, again, very systematically said, okay, we'll try it your way. We will tone down our criticism. Mm. We will send our highest officials to meet with you. We will invite the Pakistani military chief to talk to NATO and to talk, which they did a couple months ago, and to explain what your concerns are and to talk about Pakistan's sacrifices in the anti-terrorism fight. And I think the administration would say, see, it's worked.
Karen DeYoung, she's senior diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. James Kitfield is senior correspondent for the National Journal magazine. Moises Naim is editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine. When we come back, we'll talk about the EU and the economic crisis that it faces. And we're back with three of our outstanding foreign policy reporters, Moises Naim of Foreign Policy Magazine, Karen DeYoung of The Washington Post, James Kitfield of National Journal Magazine. Here's a message on Facebook from Yosef. He says, I want to know more about the apparent Mossad assassination scandal in Britain. It's a virtual media blackout here in the U.S. James.
We had a discussion on this show not long ago about our own target assassination program. Well, Israel's long had the model. It started after the 72 Olympics where their athletes were murdered. They launched a target assassination program, operation called Wrath of God, and hunted these guys down in various capitals throughout Europe. They've stopped doing so much of that, but they've continued to target Hamas leaders, mostly in Gaza, which is sort of a free fire zone. They don't get a lot of international scrutiny. What's interesting about this case was you had 11 apparent agents who went and followed this number two military head of the military wing of Hamas from Damascus to Dubai, murdered him in his hotel room, using passports that were European passports, but of Israeli citizens who had immigrated from Europe. So it left their fingerprints all over this. There's lots of security cameras in Dubai, if anyone who's been there knows. So they got pictures of these guys on the front page. So if this, even former Mossad people say this looks like it has our fingerprints on it, but boy, was this a sloppy operation.
Karen.
Well, I think that the Dubai did a report on this and has put it out and pretty much, although a lot of people have raised questions about it, pretty much made it clear what happened. And again, as James said, it's a little bit sloppy compared to previous Israeli operations.
Moises.
And there is a debate going on. You can imagine how would you feel if your name was in one of these passports. These are real people that had their passports stolen from them and then used by these assassins to kill this Hamas leader. So many of the people that whose passports and identities have been used are very stridently and correctly protesting.
All right. And your calls are welcome, 800-433-8850. Moises, why is this pending Greek bond offering so important to Europe and the euro?
And to the United States and to the global economy. This is one of the small stories that has very large implications. If Greece doesn't get the funding, Greece is issuing some debt, and if the international markets don't buy those papers, Greece may default. And if that happens, then that has consequences because Greece is part of the European monetary system, they have the euro as a currency. In the past, and this is a crisis that was generated by Greece's irresponsible behavior. They spend far too much and more than what they collect, and they have a deficit that is a public spending, that public budget deficit that is about 13% of the size of their economy. In the past, when that happened, countries used to devalue their currency. Now, because Greece has the euro, they cannot touch that. So the only way they can react and adjust is with very, very drastic budget cuts, and that will have consequences for unemployment and so on. And that in turn is connected to an even larger story that happened yesterday, which is very important, which is then that in the United States, the Federal Reserve raised for the first time since 2008 the interest rates. This is a signal that the Fed is beginning to exit the strategy of very loose money, a lot of currency flexibility.
And yet, wasn't the Fed careful to point out that it was simply the money that banks borrow in emergency cases?
Exactly, but it's it is a change
in
trend.
Signal.
And again, what one needs to pay attention to this because this is the exit from their policies that led to the partial recovery we're now witnessing. And it's very tricky. If the Fed and others do it too quickly, they can truncate the recovery. If they do it too late, they can get the spiraling debt and fiscal deficit.
Jay.
You know, a couple of interesting points about this. We found out that our friends on Wall Street were also involved in this. They were helping Greece hide its debt through some of these very complicated derivatives.
Who on Wall Street?
Oh, I think it was, I don't want to say because it's the big banks. We would know. I think it was Goldman Sachs, but I don't want to be held. I don't have that right in front of me, but it was our
Moises
big.
Moises is shaking
yeah.
his head. Yes,
and so that's kind of interesting that they were helping them hide their debt. And number two, you know, Greece is like the canary in the mine shaft right now. There's the market analysts say it's the pigs: Portugal, Ireland, Greece, Spain. If Greece starts to look very shaky, then there's the whole southern part of the eurozone starts to look very shaky, and it does make a point that when these very different countries and economies adopted this common currency. You always wondered, you know, how would it react? Because everyone who knows Greece and everyone who knows Germany has that very different discipline level in terms of spending versus, you know, revenue, et cetera. And there was a rule that said you cannot go over 3% of GDP if you want to remain in the eurozone. Well, Greece has been breaking that rule. It's 13%, as Moises said. So it does call into question the fundamental compact at the basis of the euro currency. I don't think they're going to get rid of it. It's too valuable. Germany, I think, will step up and bail them out if they have to, but they're not going to be happy about it. And I think it's going to lead to a lot more sort of scrutiny about, are you really following the rules here?
And, of course, Spain is blaming foreign analysts for all this.
Well, I think just to follow on the point that James made, I think this is a fundamental question about the way the EU works. As it's gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, you have a lot of economies that are very different from each other. And the EU has never really come up with an answer that says what happens if one of these economies gets close to crashing. And I think that's what everybody's waiting for now, to see what they're going to do. They issued a very vague statement last week saying, well, we politically support Greece. Greece is one of us. But what the banks are looking at, and what investors are looking at, is what is a specific policy? What are you going to do about this? And I think the EU doesn't have such a policy.
Spain's denouncing speculators and the media for what's happening to them follows a very well-known pattern of countries that are in economic crisis. It all starts with a denial, the authorities denying that there is a crisis, followed by the adoption of partial measures that do not work, and then they blame the media and speculators, and then the markets force them to really take the measures they should take. So Spain has gone through all this. President Zapatero, Rodriguez Zapatero, said that he denied that there was any crisis. He wouldn't even use the word crisis for a long time. Then he did a little bit of things that did not work, and now they are in the stage of blaming others. And very soon they will be forced to adopt more drastic measures.
This sounds like a real mess.
It is a real mess, and it's connected, and it is very hard to isolate. And what happens in Spain or in Greece will have consequences for the pocketbooks of everyone.
How here?
Well, the transmission belts are many. It goes from the markets for American exports and companies that are producing here and selling overseas, the interest rates, as we were talking about, and all sorts of conveyor belts that are connecting these different economies.
And now also we find that Japan has become even a larger creditor than China to the United States, James.
Yeah, it was an interesting point. China, sold a lot of its U.S. Treasury bonds, and so that by default made Japan the number one holder of our debt. And you know, we've been looking ever since there were some comments made by the Chinese last year that they're getting kind of worried about our level of debt. We've been looking for signs that their appetite for our debt may start to wane, and that could cause big problems for us if that happens. I actually don't think this was a sign of that. I mean, the euro, because of the problems we're talking about right now, has really fallen through the floor. So there aren't a lot of reserve currencies that they can turn to besides the dollar and U.S. Treasury bonds. So I actually don't think this was that big of a deal. But everyone's looking for when there is where that appetite starts to go down for China for our debt, because at that point it gets problematic.
I agree with James. That's the way to think about it. And then the question is, if indeed China loses appetite for American debt, where would it go? Would it buy euros, or would it buy, which countries? Would it buy Italian shares? There is not a lot of places in the world that have the size and scale and the type of financial system that would allow China to diversify significantly away from American debt.
All right, and one of our listeners in Intervale, New Hampshire, has a question about Iraq. She wants to know, what is the current state of play regarding the upcoming March elections in Iraq? Were the 500 suspected Ba'athist candidates reinstated? Will they be permitted to run? Karen?
Well, this started out, the Iraqi elections are 2 weeks from now. They're on the 7th of March. These are national elections, the first one since Prime Minister Maliki was elected in 2005 after a lot of horse trading among Iraqis. I think for the United States, this is a question of whether, this democratic experiment is actually going to hold there, if they're going to progress into a sustainable democracy. Part of the new constitution, which we helped put in place, in Iraq, calls for de-Ba'athification, which is removing anyone who had anything to do with the party of Saddam Hussein. The people who control the de-Ba'athification process are considered to be very close to Iran, which would like a strong Shia government in Iraq. And so they put out a list, to the surprise of everyone, that had more than 500 people on it who they charged had some kind of ties with the Ba'ath Party and were therefore ineligible to run for elections. These were all people who had been promoted by their parties. Most of them, the majority Shia, but because Sunnis are in the minority there, the number of Sunnis there was a concern. It was seen as an effort to push the Sunnis out of contention. There was a lot of maneuvering. The list has been whittled down to about 120 people. The Americans at least think that the crisis has passed. None of the major parties, including the Sunni parties, have said they will boycott the election, which was one of the big concerns. But I think that everyone's sort of on tenterhooks, waiting to see if this is actually going to work.
James.
One of the interesting little sidebars to this story is the person who is running the commission, which is totally opaque. No one understands what criteria you use as to how close you are to the Ba'ath Party and what remaining ties you may have to the Ba'ath Party, is Ahmed Chalabi. You know, we've been through this story before with this guy. He was put in charge of de-Ba'athification by the Bush administration and Paul Bremer. He did the same thing, trying to clear the field of Sunnis so his political rivals. It's not very helpful.
James Kitfield of National Journal Magazine, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And Karen, you mentioned the Shia and the connection with Iran. What was behind Secretary of State Clinton's remarks about Iran becoming a military dictatorship, Moises?
Secretary Clinton has been going around in the region, and she gave a speech in which she stressed again that she is convinced and that the U.S. government is persuaded that now Iran has moved into a full-fledged military dictatorship, that the system is no longer controlled by the elected officials, but by the mullahs, even, but by the Revolutionary Guards, who control the large chunks of the economy, if not all, the biggest construction companies, the banks, and so on. They also have the control of the nuclear development program. They have the control of the army and, of course, the intelligence services.
But what is the significance of her saying this is becoming a military dictatorship, James?
The significance is the dual track they followed for the last year. Engagement on one side, pressure on the other, has turned to all pressure now because the hand has been slapped. They gave them a December deadline to sort of react to the Obama administration's offer of exporting some of their uranium. The Iranians have basically just slapped that hand away, so now they're going to pressure. Now the sort of interesting factor is this internal opposition movement has really shaken the regime inside Iran. So they want to target sanctions in a way that is kind of a twofer. You hurt the guys who are behind the nuclear and weapons program, the Revolutionary Guard, but you also hurt the guys who are cracking down on the opposition, also the Revolutionary Guard. So they're starting to say very strong things about a military dictatorship, trying to exacerbate the divisions the opposition has already opened in society.
And,
Iran.
Of course, you've got this new IAEA report, and that kind of fuels perhaps the U.S. moving toward sanctions.
Yeah, I think that this is the first report under the new Director General of the IAEA. It hasn't been approved by the Board of Governors yet, but it's pretty tough. And so that, as far as the Americans are concerned, at least, is a good sign that the IAEA will continue to put pressure on. But I think Clinton's comments were, as James said, directed to a lot of different targets. I found it interesting because she seemed to be saying to the religious leaders in Iran, as well as to the political opposition, saying, look, you guys aren't in charge of this country, almost trying to embarrass them and say, you've lost control. You've lost control not only in a political sense, but, as Moise said, of the economy, of the nuclear program. And you're irrelevant in this country now because the Quds Force, the Revolutionary Guard, are controlling everything.
It's important also to note that one of the successes of the Obama administration and Secretary Clinton is that they have been effective in getting the support of two important players, namely Russia and China, perhaps even Russia more than China. They are important players in all this, especially if this heightened rhetoric is to set the stage for more drastic sanctions against Iran that would require the support of China and Russia in a variety of ways. And that seems to be holding despite all of the frictions.
So here we are dealing with China and trying to get their support on Iran, and the president meets today with the Dalai Lama.
Yeah, I think it was yesterday, but might be today. But yeah, he and that was been telegraphed for quite a while, and it's just one more of a number of irritants in the U.S.-Sino relationship. You had the whole Google issue where Google threatened to pull out of China because of all the hacking. You had the situation where we just announced a $6.4 billion arms trade to Taiwan, which is, you know, by law we have to do that, but it's always, you know, hurts our relationship. And you have this issue with Iran. So it comes at a bad time. A lot of people are wondering whether this relationship is really going south. This week something happened that you didn't hear a lot about, which was the Chinese allowed a U.S. carrier battle group Nimitz to sort of stop into Hong Kong. When they're really, really mad, they don't allow that sort of thing. So China obviously does not want this to get too heated up in terms of ruining the relationship.
James Kitfield of National Journal, Karen DeYoung of the Washington Post, Moises Naim, Foreign Policy Magazine. Short break, and when we come back, we'll open the phones. I look forward to hearing your comments on this week's International Friday News Roundup.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, providing schools that work, strategies for 21st century success. Learn more at edutopia.org, by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
The Informant is out on DVD and Blu-ray. On the next Fresh Air, the film's star Matt Damon and director Steven Soderbergh talk about collaborating on this dark comedy about a rising corporate executive at Archer Daniels Midland who blows the whistle on price fixing. But he has his own secrets he's keeping from the feds. Join us.
Welcome back. It's time to open the phones in our Friday News Roundup, the international hour of our Friday News Roundup. I know many of you have questions. We'll try to work in just as many as we can. First, let's go to Miami, Florida. Noam, you're on the air.
Hello, Diane. How are you today?
Fine, thank you.
I really enjoy your show. I'm an Israeli American, and I wanted to comment about this assassination situation and the Israeli government's involvement. I have a military background, let's say, in intelligence, and I'm not sure about the U.S., but in Israel, there's a big difference between the government intelligence, military intelligence, and Mossad. Mossad is an independent organization, and the panel person, I forgot who it was, who said that Mossad's been commenting on this. Mossad does not make public statements about any activities. They have various people represented in the Israeli government who make statements, but nothing so quick. And this has zero markings of a Mossad action. If you know the history of Mossad, the reason they are, for us, like angels, is their ability to be much more clandestine, you say, maybe. But it does not take 11 people, and they certainly do not have a track record of putting Israelis in harm's way. Using identities of Israeli citizens to carry out their business is not a marking of Mossad whatsoever.
All right. Thanks for your call. James.
That was me who mentioned that comment. It was from a former Mossad official who was quoted, I think, in the New York Times. But he was definitely saw a quote from the former Mossad official who said, this does look like it has our fingerprints on it.
And
but
yet here's an email saying, was the alleged Israeli hit squad purposely sloppy? Were they sending a message to the enemies?
You know, both listeners make the same point that we don't know a lot about here. So I don't want to go out and say, I know exactly what happened.
Sure.
I don't know what happened. I would say that he's got a point, though. If it is Mossad, it's a sloppy Mossad operation because they usually are much more, a lot more plausible deniability than they have here. And I'll just leave it at that.
All right. To Owings Mill, Maryland. Good morning, Matthew. You're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to make a couple of comments about the European situation. The first one is I read a lot on finance, and when people refer to pigs, they typically use two eyes. They include Italy, which is significant because obviously Italy is a much larger economy, and Italy apparently used the same sorts of derivatives that Greece did, only they went with J.P. Morgan Chase as opposed to Goldman Sachs. Yeah, and the second point is there was a rather blithe statement made that Greece is spending too much money. And in the EU, or at least in the non-former Western, former NATO part of the EU, Greece actually has among the least generous social welfare programs. Their problem isn't spending. Their problem is that they do not have a functional tax collection system. Evasion is endemic, as is corruption. And the real problem is that they never should have been in the euro in the first place, but teasing that out is impossible.
All of those are very good points. It is true that Greece does not have a very large social welfare system, but it is also true that the spending in Greece is irresponsible and profligate. It is also true that they cannot balance their accounts, and it's also true that they cook their books. There is a lot of opacity in Greece's accounts, and that has been a long there's a long history of the impossibility of really understanding what's going on with their accounts. And the Italy point is correct. Italy is also using the derivatives. They are more creative, however. They use it at the level of municipalities. And so it is not the federal government that uses derivatives in Italy, but it is the state and local governments that finance their debts with these very complicated financial instruments.
I sure am getting worried about the activity of these banks, whichever ones they are, not only here in this country, but around the world. This is getting worse and worse, Moises.
And that's why there is such a demand for a better system of regulating.
Course.
Now, the problem with that is that it's very hard to have a universal system. And so you're going to have asymmetries in which the regulations that apply in Europe are not exactly the same as here, and that in turn create great opportunities for those that know how to game the system and use gaps and the contradictions between regulations here and there.
Let's go to Greece, New York, and to Thomas. Good morning to you.
Yes, hello. Well, this isn't something that's been mentioned on the show today, but it's been an ongoing issue, and that's China's deregulation of its currency, I believe. And I've heard that criticized. I mean, I've heard that mentioned, and it's always as if China is doing that to somehow be at an advantage with the United States. I don't understand how a country devaluing its currency can put it at an advantage.
Moises.
Devaluing a currency boosts your exports. It makes your exports more competitive and makes imports more expensive. So it is a tool that countries use to grow the market share of the companies abroad. The issue of China currency is a very hot issue. It is, and
the accusation has been that...
And the accusation is that they keep their currency artificially low and therefore subsidize their exports, and that's why it's so hard to compete with Chinese manufacturers. But this is a subject that is going to be with us for a long time.
All right, let's go to Chris in Lincoln, Nebraska. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. I'm a huge fan. I want to say your show makes me a more informed citizen.
I'm so glad. Thank you.
My question was about James Kitfield's comment about Ahmad Chalabi still being involved in the Iraqi political system. I was just curious as to how much power this man still has, considering his shady reputation.
It is a very good question, James Kitfield.
And if your viewer can get to the bottom of it, I'd love to hear about it, because it's astounding to me. Clearly, the Americans have been frustrated by this guy forever. He's got we had General Odierno was in town this week, the chief U.S. commander in Iraq, saying that he has close ties to Iran. That they've tracked him going to Iran and meeting with senior officials. So clearly, this is not a guy on who has our interest in mind. You know, but you have to believe that he has some sway with Prime Minister Maliki, or otherwise he wouldn't be in this key position.
You know, Chris Hill, who's the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, has been here this week and made a lot of public statements. And he was asked this several times: what's the constituency that Ahmad Chalabi has? And he's described it as a sort of way of looking at how the United States needs to be a lot more humble about what it knows about the inner workings of a country. I mean, Ahmad Chalabi was not only a favorite of the Bush administration and certainly of the U.S. Defense Department. He was thought of as someone they wanted to put in as prime minister in Iraq. And he ran the exile organizations here. He was sent there specifically. He was put in charge of this system in 03 and 04 when Paul Bremer was there. And so he clearly had a different agenda. And he has been acting on that agenda. And I think that the question I have had is as the Iraqis in this electoral process denounce the United States for interfering, and this is all part of their politics, you don't hear very much denunciation of Iran.
James Kitfield, I want to ask you about the missionaries in Haiti, why the judge decided to release 8 and hold 2.
Decided to release the 8 because they got the parents of these they weren't orphans, they were the parents of these children in, who basically testified that they gave them the children to these missionaries freely because they were promised a better life. And certainly after the earthquake, those parents who were desperate said, okay, take the kids. So the judge said, okay, you 8 can go. They kept 2, the leader and her nanny, because they had been there in December before the earthquake, trying to sort of facilitate orphans leaving the country. And the judge wants to know more about what they were actually up to. One of them is apparently under medical watch right now, so he's waiting to see to interrogate them further.
James Kitfield, senior correspondent for National Journal. Karen DeYoung of The Washington Post. Moises Naim of Foreign Policy Magazine. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Moises, you want to add to that?
Yes, regarding Haiti, the motives of the missionaries might have been noble, but there are other international networks operating in Haiti that are far less noble. There are people traffickers are already operating in Haiti. And we saw that before when the tsunami hit Indonesia. There were also reports that there were some children and orphans that were being kidnapped and traded internationally. That is happening also in Haiti today.
Karen.
I think, too, that some of the people who were released have specifically said that the woman who organized them to go down there had misled them in terms of what it was they were there for. They have consistently said, and the leader has consistently said, that they weren't there to put these kids out for adoption or take them out of the country. But if you look at their own website, it specifically said that this was the goal. They were going to take these kids to the Dominican Republic as a kind of interim step and then find adoptive families for them.
And one final question for you all. Why is the UN climate change chief quitting? Moises.
Ivo de Boer is a Dutch civil servant that was in charge of the negotiations that led to the Copenhagen meeting. For 4 years, he led what is called the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, that was in charge of implementing one of those treaties. And essentially, he's living in frustration that the meeting did not go well, that meeting achieved even far less than the minimalist expectations were. And this just is another signal that in this very important issue of our time, where governments need to work together, we are not achieving it. We have failings, and it's going to become an even more complicated issue.
And they're supposed to meet again this summer, are they not, James?
I think that's right. And you know, Copenhagen was, I expected this guy to almost say, you know, I want to spend more time with my family, because that's usually what you hear, and that it shows you that it's really behind the scenes. He's hit a brick wall. Copenhagen was seen as kind of a almost a disaster. It wasn't quite a disaster, because they got some sort of voluntary agreements agreed upon, but it was pretty bad. And right now, President Obama has almost zero political capital to push through a cap and trade. So it's hard to see this thing getting to the front burner in the next year or so.
All right. To Carol, who's in Quincy, Illinois. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to question.
Certainly.
I question about the power of the word or language. It fuels politics. It promotes military actions. It cultivates terrorists both abroad and here at home, as close as Austin, Texas. To what extent are we all responsible for the immense power of our language?
Who wants to take a crack at that? James Kitfield.
Well, we're all wordsmiths at this table here. So we all, I think, all appreciate very much that words are very powerful things. That's one of the things that makes me kind of enticing to go into a business where you do it for a living.
But, you know, I think ultimately referring to Iran in the way Secretary Clinton did signals a shift not only in language but in purpose.
Sure, I think that there's a game going on, not a game, but it's part of the policy going on where, particularly in Iran, as has been said previously, there are a lot of different goals in sight. The negotiation offer is still on the table, although it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. There is maneuvering going on in the Security Council, trying to get China to agree to sanctions. Every day the Russians say something about it, the Chinese say something about it, and many of those statements are kind of in code as you try to figure out where people stand. I know in the past it was always assumed that whatever the Russians did in the Security Council, the Chinese would sort of come along behind ultimately and follow them. That assumption doesn't seem to work anymore, but nobody's clear if when the Chinese stand up and say, we won't put up with this, we don't want this to happen, when they make angry statements about U.S. actions vis-a-vis China, nobody's clear, I think, at this point as to whether this is the usual sort of gamesmanship or something fundamentally different.
The caller is absolutely right that words and language can lead to violence, but I much rather have negotiations of words and exchanges of tough words than having actual wars.
And the question becomes, can the Secretary of State's statement identifying Iran in the way she has change the perception enough to avoid any kind of military action or lead to it, James?
Well, it is an interesting question. We saw this in the run-up to the Iraq War, where we saw the rhetoric got hotter and hotter, to where you're demonizing him. Mushroom clouds were on the horizon, supporter of terror. And a lot of what that rhetoric suggested was not actually the case. So we have to be very careful as we ratchet up towards these things. But, I mean, it's true that calling it a military dictatorship, probably true, brings us a step closer to confrontation of some sort, whether it's rhetorical or whether it's military. But the circumstances on the ground, they are suspected of building a nuclear weapon.
I understand.
So the circumstances themselves are building us closer to a confrontation.
Moises.
Today, the Iran supreme leader said that the Islamic Republic is in seeking and doesn't believe in pursuing nuclear bombs. He said Iran will not get emotional in its response to these nonsensical statements because we have often said that in our religious tenets and beliefs consider these kinds of weapons of mass destruction to be symbols of genocide and are therefore forbidden and considered to be harm. He said this at the same day that there was a report released saying that they are building a nuclear warhead.
Moises, you have the last word. Moises Naim, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy Magazine, James Kitfield of National Journal Magazine, Karen DeYoung of The Washington Post. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I will be at WUNC in North Carolina Monday and Tuesday. I'll be back with you on Wednesday. Hope you have a great weekend. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.